Next item on our agenda here is number three, item number 357462, MD Holdings LLC versus RL Detman Company.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is RJ Cronkite. I am counsel for the plaintiff's appellants in this matter. The court should reverse the grant of summary disposition pursuant to MCR 2.116 C8 and C10 for four reasons. The first reason is that it was premature. There was no answer filed in this matter. There was a motion brought in lieu of an answer. I rushed to take as much discovery as I could while that motion was pending. I think there were approximately 3 or 4 months of discovery, initial exchange of written discovery, requests and responses, and I was able to take only two depositions. I took the people at the center from R.L. Detman, the Pele, I took two depositions, Mr. Schmidt and Ms. McDonald's. That's all I was able to take. Typically, as this court is aware, dismissal pursuant to C-10 is premature when fact discovery remains open. The second reason is that there's
What other depositions would you have taken? I mean, you said you took the two main people.
I would have taken the signatory of the sales agreement, the President Van Gore. I certainly would have taken, more importantly, a corporate representative deposition, because the entire executive team of R.L. Detman was involved in this marketing and sale of the Southfield property. And I was never able to take a corporate representative deposition. I got to Mr. Schmidt. I started with Mr. Schmidt because he was the manager of the facility that was sold, the headquarters of R.L. Detman. And I figured that he would be a good place to start. But with such limited time to conduct discovery, I couldn't take all the depositions I needed, but it would principally be the corporate rep deposition in order to get everyone, because I would be guessing in terms of who was involved in the various deviations from the 1980 site plan that had been approved. I don't know who was involved. I imagine it would be the executive team, which I think was approximately 5 or 6 people, including Mr. Schmidt.
Who signed the purchase agreement on behalf of the company?
Well, interesting question. Two people. The first, Your Honor, was Mr. John Alisi, who's a plaintiff. He signed the initial purchase agreement. There was an amendment after the purchase agreement was signed that swapped out, because there was a placeholder company as the purchasing company, a company to be formed. MD Holdings was then formed, and then there was an amendment done to the original purchase agreement that Mr. Jeremy Steiner, another plaintiff, signed, that actually identified MD Holdings as the purchasing entity. So two parties, Mr. Alisi for the first agreement, and then the amendment to that agreement was Jeremy Steiner, both on behalf of MD Holdings. The second reason the court should reverse is there's a fact issue on the breach of contract claim. So the trial court dismissed under C-10, finding that there was no fact issue on the breach of the sales agreement. So it's a very specific breach. There was a rep and warranty made in paragraph 28 of the sale agreement of saying that R.L. Detman was not aware of facts, quote, which might result in an action, suit, or other proceedings, end quote. This rep and warranty was breached, is the plaintiff's claim. And even in the preliminary discovery that I was able to conduct within this handful of months, including Mr. Schmidt's testimony, I think and some of the documents I was able to obtain. There was a fact issue regarding that knowledge, regarding that breach of rep and warranty, saying we're not aware of anything, that any facts that would result in proceedings against you, purchaser. Well, we know that's not true, and I'll get into that a little more deeply in a moment here. Reversal number three, tort claims. The tort claims were reversed strictly under CA, failure to state a claim, specifically under the economic loss doctrine. It was misapplied. It was misapplied for two specific reasons. First off, as Huron Tool noted, the economic loss doctrine doesn't even apply to fraudulent misrepresentation claims. And the court just ignored that and did a shotgun approach and said, oh, nope, the economic loss doctrine bars all tort claims, my negligent misrepresentation claim, innocent misrepresentation claim, silent fraud, and my fraudulent inducement claim. It just doesn't even apply to one of those theories. It doesn't apply to the other theories because an exception to that, it's really not an exception, it's the threshold question of whether the economic loss doctrine applies, which is there a duty distinct from the contract? There is. It's a duty to disclose. And I won't regurgitate my briefing because I know the court has gone through that and read it. I'm happy to answer any questions about this case as I cited, but there's over half a century, 70, 80 years of real estate case law, both in the residential and the commercial context, showing that you have cases in which there is a contract to purchase real estate, on the one hand, and yet the court allows tort claims, specifically intentional tort claims, fraud claims.
Can I direct you to a different area? It seems to me that you're alleging that the defendant executed an owner's affidavit after the purchase agreement was executed.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And that affidavit affirmatively stated, in the quote, that the use of the property is in compliance with all terms and conditions, covenants, and or restrictions affecting the property created in a plat of the property, and it goes on from there.
Correct.
So
you're referring to Mr. Van Gore's affidavit.
Right.
Which was, that is Exhibit 10 in the appendix. And that's kind of a problem in this case, is you have to look at, I think, 3 points in time to assess the fraud claims, because you had fraudulent inducement.
Well, it seems to me that as much as your client had to conduct due diligence, it seems that it's plausible that affidavit could have induced your client into complacency, constituting some sort of fraud extraneous to the purchase agreement.
Precisely, Your Honor. And that's exactly what happened here. You had fraud in the...
Why was that affidavit filed after the purchase agreement? And then I sort of have a follow-up question to Judge Krause. If you have a purchase agreement, what significance does a filing post-purchase agreement have if it's not amended to the purchase agreement, quite frankly?
So, Your Honor, the reason that the owner's affidavit is signed is because they're as part of the due diligence process post-sale, post-execution of the agreement, a due diligence period takes place. And then...
Well, I understand that, but what significance is it when you have a signed purchase agreement and the law says your contract is the purchase agreement, unless it is amended according to certain terms and executed? I mean, I don't really see the significance of filing an affidavit after the fact, quite frankly.
Well, you know, Your Honor, I guess if that were true, then why would, and these are routinely executed in connection with real estate transactions. Executed in connection with due diligence periods and closings.
I have never seen one in any of the cases that we've had in commercial transactions. But go ahead.
They're
routinely executed. What still is the legal significance is what I'm asking you, and they could execute whatever they like.
Yeah,
What is the legal significance
of
that?
Right, to tag on to Judge Jantz's, isn't that the purpose of the due diligence period? I mean, your client's not going to take the representations from the other side as 100% accurate, right? That's why you have the due diligence period to verify that everything's according to what they say.
Well, the due diligence period, Your Honor, and this is partially why the breach of contract claim dismissal is improper, it violates cardinal contract principles, which is you cannot have, you got to read the contract as a whole, got to give effect to all provisions, and you can't render any of them nugatory based on the interpretation. So what the trial court did is said, well, you've got a due diligence period, you've got an as-is clause. And when given those items, the burden was on my client in order to figure out these deviations. The problem with that interpretation, under just black letter contract law, if that is true, then what effect does the representation and warranty in paragraph 28 have? It has absolutely no effect if you say, well, caveat emptor, you signed a contract with an as-is and due diligence period. Now, because you have a due diligence period, the burden is completely on you in order to figure out whether we told the truth, whether our rep and warranty is true. That's not what contract law calls for. You have to give effect to all the provisions. And to circle back in the owner's affidavit, and I think Judge Krause touched on this, it did lure complacency. Not only did we have a rep and warranty in the original purchase agreement, but during the due diligence period that happened thereafter, two specific things happened in order to give further reassurances that there's nothing to see here, everything's fine. One was the Alta survey that showed the 46 parking spaces, which were not permitted, and 21 of which were, actually 20 of which.
But approved by the city. The city gave approval after, initiated a permit. Approved by the city.
Only, Your Honor, only in, it was an 11, and only, Your Honor, for the originally approved site plan in 1980, which is what Southfield's planning department head, Sarah Mullally, wrote to Mr. Schmidt in 2011. And actually emailed him the 1980 approved site plan. And then when the permit was issued a few months after, that was in May of 2011, and then in July of 2011, when the permit for the parking repaving and restriping was issued, the permit itself says that you have to pave and stripe in accordance with the approved site plan. And that's the problem, is they didn't do that. They did not, in fact, it was...
The city of Southfield doesn't come out after issuing a permit and when the job is done and make sure it's in conformance with the permit? They never took any action.
Oh, gee golly, I wish all municipalities...
So they never took any action, and they did whatever they did regarding the parking spaces. How can you impute that the defendant had knowledge that this was not in conformance with a site plan issued, what, how many years previously? 30 years or something?
1980, Your Honor.
So quite a few, decades. 30-some years?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, I'm not great at arithmetic.
Nor am I.
So, but, you know.
In terms of imputing knowledge.
Because it's okay.
The city didn't, in the record, there is nothing in the record that actually shows Southfield came out and examined the work done pursuant to that permit and signed off on it. I think that would be a significant fact if that were in the record. It's not. And
they didn't take any action against them, did they?
No, they took it against my client post-purchase.
All right, but at that time, they issued a permit. Typically, they should come out. And there are issues with inspections. I'll give you that. But what would give notice to the defendants that there's a problem here?
Well, Your Honor, I would refer to, this is Exhibit 13 in the appendix, which is the May 25th, 2011 email from Sarah Mullally to first Jan McDonald, and then Ms. McDonald forwards it the same day to Mr. Schmidt. And the reason this is important is Mr. Schmidt, I asked him about this at deposition. I said, well, you knew that given the significance of the work that was being proposed to be done, you knew this required permitting, didn't you? He said, yeah, a project of this scope? Yeah, it did. So he actually had Jan McDonald reach out to Southfield to inquire about permitting. Now, if it just stopped there, okay, maybe that's not enough to say there's a fact issue in terms of knowledge of issues that could lead to proceedings. But this is the issue. Southfield actually not only spoke to them, saying you, not only do you need a permit, but Ms. Mullally emailed the 1980 approved site plan to guide them in compliance with the permit, and the permit that was issued a few months later in July specifically required them to follow the approved site plan. And so that is the notice, is that R.L. Detman understood, at least there's a fact issue at this stage, taking all facts and inferences in favor of non-movement under C8, or C10, excuse me, there's certainly a fact issue in terms of whether Mr. Schmidt, after he reached out to Southfield and had the approved site plan emailed, and he admitted in his deposition that he received and reviewed the permit, there certainly is a fact issue in terms of whether he's telling the truth when he says, I didn't notice. And that was what the trial court noted in its opinion, that Mr. Schmidt admits that he reached out to Southfield, admits that Southfield sent him the previously
approved. He just forwarded it on to the asphalt company, is that what he claims, right?
That is correct.
Right.
And that's
here
correct.
You go. And but I think maybe it was going to what Judge Jansen was saying, is that didn't the two people that you deposed both testify that the number of spaces were the same as long as they had been there? Parking spaces?
That's what they testified to, Your
yeah.
Honor. If you look at Exhibit 17, this is the Ellen's Asphalt was the paving company that they had used. If you look at Exhibit 17, what's really interesting there, that is the previous work that was done on the Southfield property parking lot. Look at the notes in terms of the scope of the work. 26 spaces. 26 spaces are restriped, not 46. In 2011, that's Exhibit 18, you're gonna see that now there's 46 spaces. And so I think that's a fact issue in terms of the credibility when Mr. Schmidt says, it was always that way. Ever since I started working here and managing this property, I just had them do exactly what was always there. The documents directly contradict that. The 2009 scope of work for Allen's Asphalt is the immediately preceding work that was done on that property, which kind of makes sense. You know, a few years pass before there's additional work done. It's 2 years before the work in 2011. So if it's true that it was a 2011 job was simply a redoing of what had always been there, then why does the 2009 scope of work mark 26 spaces? Which, not coincidentally, is what the approved site plan permitted.
That's Exhibit 17?
Yes, Your Honor. You'll see it in the notes. It says 25 double yellow lines, and then one blue line, one blue handicap, one blue access, which I take that those last three to constitute the handicap parking space, 26 spaces. And so, but I want to circle back on an owner's affidavit, because I think this was what I was struggling with, is that once I sign a contract, because this is really what the court and, you know, R.L. Detman's argue in terms of applying the economic loss doctrine, and I really struggled with this. Once you sign a contract, it really insulates tort liability, meaning that I can sign a contract such as the sales agreement, trigger your due diligence period, starts, and then throughout the due diligence period, I am immune to make misrepresentations throughout that due diligence period, which, circling back on Judge Krause's point, lures the other side into not fully exercising their rights because they're getting continued misrepresentations, including this owner's affidavit saying, not only do we not have knowledge of facts that could lead to proceedings, that is the rep and warranty in paragraph 28 of the sales agreement, but we have complied with the plat plan. We have done nothing inconsistent with that plan. It's even more specific.
They didn't say that. We have complied with the plat plan. I don't see that in the purchase agreement.
No, Your Honor, it's not. Exactly. It's not. It's in.
Counsel, these are two very sophisticated commercial endeavors. They're not mom and pop buyers, you know. So any I mean, for you to say that because someone, the seller's representing to them, everything's good and we don't know anything. I mean, they're not stupid. I'm sure they don't take that at face value because they're buying a million-dollar property. I don't know. What was the purchase price?
$710,000, I believe, Your Honor.
Almost $1 million.
Yeah.
They're not going to fall for somebody saying, oh, it's okay, let me pat you on the head, don't worry about a thing. I mean, these are sophisticated people. They didn't just show up one day.
Well, my client, respectfully, is a relatively unsophisticated commercial client.
Oh, yes.
But nonetheless, I go back to contract principles.
I don't know if your client would agree with you on that point. I'd be interested to see what your client had to say.
Well, Your Honor, going back to contract principles, I'm not aware of a contract
I know, but rule. You're making the argument they were lulled into submission and they didn't, you know, they just were like, oh, okay, everything's hunky-dory. We're just going to spend all this money and not do any due diligence ourselves or check things out. I mean, that's absurd. That's absurd that somebody in this position would be that naive, shall I say.
Well, Your Honor, it's not that they didn't do any due diligence.
Oh, all
it's
right.
it's that their due diligence didn't catch the misrepresentations that were made. And I circle back to the question, what function does the rep and warranty play if that due diligence period completely shifts all burden to catch misrepresentations made either as part of the executing that purchase agreement or in the subsequent due diligence proceedings and documents that are tendered in connection with that, such as the ALTA survey and it's the owner's affidavit, Your Honor, that contains that deviation from the plat plan language. The rep and warranty is completely mooted at that point.
Did your client have the 1980 plat available to it?
It did not have it. It could have gone, and this is what I mean by relatively unsophisticated purchaser, it could have gone to Southfield and FOIA'd that information. That's what I did after this dispute arose, but they did not. And it's not in the record that the purchaser, MD Holdings, actually had the 1980 approved site plan. We know Mr. Schmidt had it. So the economic loss doctrine, so first off, on the breach of contract, after 4 months of discovery, two depositions, a single exchange of written discovery, there is a fact issue in terms of whether R.L. Detman had knowledge of facts that could lead to a proceeding. Mr. Schmidt's credibility was weighed upon and opined upon by the trial court. And with all due respect to the learned trial court, that is not the trial court's function in a jury case. He said, well, Mr. Schmidt testified that he didn't notice it. Well, that's fine. You can observe that, Your Honor, but it's up to the jury to determine whether that's believable. And what I submit is that given the documents showing that Mr. Schmidt was integrally involved in getting this project permitted, reviewing the permit, receiving the 1980 approved site plan as part of that, it's up to the jury to determine whether Mr. Schmidt is to be believed when he said, I didn't notice. The jury could find that, but it's premature at this stage to dismiss under C-10. Now, under the economic loss doctrine, I just want to touch upon that briefly and answer any questions. What I find happened in this case, and based on the trial court's interpretation and application of the economic loss doctrine as argued by R.L. Detman, it's ironic to me because, if you go back to Nybarger, which kind of was the first marquee decision formally recognizing the economic loss doctrine in Michigan, in the UCC context, it was this concern that contract law will drown in tort. And what happened here, based on the interpretation of the economic loss doctrine, it's the reversal. It's actually contract law is drowning torts, which is to say once you sign a contract, you don't have any tort claims. And which is a really perverse policy, because that means once I sign a contract, I have a free-for-all to make all these misrepresentations to you, not only in the inducement of executing the contract, but in subsequent due diligence periods. And I don't think the case law in Michigan in the real estate context, both the commercial and the residential side, which goes back to your point, Your Honor, saying it's a sophisticated purchaser, commercial parties, very expensive property, they should have known better, they're not that naive. Look at the Benson case. That was the termite hotel case, commercial case, where a hotel was motel was purchased by a commercial party. And there was a finding, despite a contract existing in Benson, that fraud claims could proceed. And so what the application of the ELD by the trial court here says that, well, you sign a contract, then the tort claims can't coexist with that contract if they're even tangentially related to the transaction. But that would just allow parties to lie through their teeth and say, well, all you do is have contract remedies. What about...
You made that argument now several times. We have heard that argument.
Understood, Your Honor. So the application of the economic loss doctrine, what is the independent duty other than the contract? Because that's really what the question comes down to. And it's a duty to disclose. That is the independent duty which the case law I cited in my briefing talks about. If you look at the Wolf and the Black case and McConkie, you see this principle arising not only that fraud and the inducement is an exception to the economic loss doctrine, but that there is a duty to disclose if you become aware of facts that make a prior misrepresentation inaccurate. And so what appellants argue is that when you're looking at whether an independent duty exists, it does. It's the duty to disclose these facts that we argue Arl Dettman knew. Now, Arl Dettman's going to say that that's not true. We didn't know. They've already made that argument in response to the breach of contract dismissal. But for purposes of C8, which it was dismissed, failure to state a claim. Well, I think we need to go to the next phase, which is, well, were there facts known to Arl Dettman that they failed to disclose, that they omitted either through inattention under negligent misrepresentation or silent fraud theory, or intentionally concealed under a more direct fraud claim? That's a fact question, but I never even got there because the trial court dismissed under CA. So I think the economic loss doctrine was applied. And I don't know if the court wants to address the cross appeal now. I would simply say, and I kind of think I could just rest on the briefing here, attorney fees were requested in a boilerplate, you know, conclusion of the motion for summary disposition by Arl Dettman. They didn't even cite any of the court rules. They did no legal analysis. It's one of those throwaways, please give us our fees. They didn't bring the motions that were required under the court rules in order to seek fees. The trial court made no finding of this being a frivolous case, and I think the briefing shows this is most certainly not a frivolous case. So I do oppose the cross appeal because they did not properly bring that question before the court and below, and it's not this court's job to do Arl Dettman's job for it. So if there's no further questions, I'll reserve the rest for
you. No other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Response?
May it please the court, Linda Rollins Ozist on behalf of appellee Arl Dettman. Prior Rollins got married, now Ozist, in case that's confusing. There's no issue of material fact regarding the breach of contract claims in this case. Opposing counsel R.J. Cronkite on November 21st, 2018, emailed Sarah K. Mullally of the City of Southfield, assistant city planner, and stated in his email to the City of Southfield that Arl Dettman was never given notice that there was any problem with the parking spaces or the office space. And he also stated it was constructed over 25 years ago and Southfield never objected. So this email was sent to the City of Southfield prior to the filing of the complaint in this case. Council, in doing its due diligence, discovered that our client was never put on notice from the City of Southfield that anything was wrong with the parking lot or the office space, and in attempting to obtain the certificate of occupancy for his client, he admitted same in communications to the City of Southfield. There's no evidence of any communication from the City of Southfield ever putting Arl Detman on notice of any issue related to the office space or the square footage.
Well, all right, but what about the email that was forwarded to Schmidt or whatever his name was, that had the 1980, plat? I know he testified he didn't look at it. One, that, it's not necessarily up to the judge to say that's beyond dispute. Isn't there some inference that can be made that they should have been aware because it was sent to them in light of a request to do permitting?
Your Honor, in order to make that inference, we would argue that an inference upon an inference upon an inference would have to be made, because there's no contents of that email, there's no communication from the City of Southfield saying anything about that site plan. They're just mailing it to him saying, here's what we have on record as the site plan. Our client is a business owner and a property owner, but he's not a contractor, he's not in construction, he's not trained to analyze a site plan. He forwarded that along to his contractor, to the asphalt company. There was no communication contained in that email along with the site plan that would have put our client on notice that he should look at it more closely, that it was different from the way that the property was currently situated. You would have to make multiple levels of inferences, yes, to conclude that perhaps somehow he could have determined that. But there's nothing in the record to corroborate that, to show that that at all happened or could have happened. There's no fraud in the inducement in this case. The only piece of evidence that appellant puts forth as evidence of fraud in the inducement is a brochure describing the square footage of office space and the number of parking spaces on the property. What appellant fails to ever mention at any time is that those pieces of information were accurate. They were true. There was 6,000 square feet of office space. There were 45 parking spaces. It was not a misrepresentation in terms of what was being sold to the purchaser. Those were true representations. And there has been nothing put forward to say that our client represented that they had any knowledge of any issue with the changes made to the property many years ago when those improvements were made. They cite to Exhibit 10 in their brief, which is this document that says it's for the First American Title Insurance Company, signed only by Mr. Van Gore, the president of my client's company. It's clear that this document was for First American Title Insurance Company, and this document is not signed or endorsed by appellants or any of its representatives. This is not an agreement between the parties. And this was also signed after the purchase agreement was signed. So it couldn't possibly have induced appellants to sign the purchase agreement in any way.
What about the significance of the owner's affidavit filed after the signing of the purchase agreement? What's the significance of that, if any?
So that's the document I'm referring to. That's Exhibit 10. That's the first.
What is the significance of filing after a purchase agreement from a legal point of view? Does it affect the purchase agreement? Is it an additional warranty or representation? I mean, what is your conclusion on that, on that affidavit?
Yes, Your Honor. Our conclusion is that it doesn't affect the purchase agreement in any way. The purchase agreement contains all of its terms. There can't be any outside additional agreements. The purchase agreement stands alone.
And why file it?
Well, it appears to have been required by the First American Title Insurance Company in order for them to provide title insurance in relation to the
transaction. Well, then it does have some significance.
It has significance in that it was required by the title insurance company, and our client signed it with the best of his knowledge.
Right, so then we're just supposed to ignore it and not say that it applies?
No, Your Honor, we're not supposed to ignore it, but it's not a representation that was made as part of the purchase agreement between the parties. It was a requirement by the title insurance company. To the best of our client's knowledge, he signed it. To the best of his knowledge, there were no issues. But it wasn't an additional warranty to appellants that
Just to the title of the property. Interesting.
Just to the title company, warranting that to their knowledge, there were no issues that would hinder the title, that would place an encumbrance on the title. And to that end,
this doesn't impact the title.
To that end, there's never been an allegation in this case that the lack of appellant's ability to obtain their certificate of occupancy encumbers the title in any way. And that relates back to their breach of warranty deed, breach of contract claim, which fails for that reason.
But why isn't there a question of fact on, I think counsel said it was Exhibit 17, which is when they were, in 2009, they were doing parking lot work.
Sure.
And it said 26 spaces.
Sure. So if you look to Exhibit 19, there's no description on here whether or not it was for both of the parking lots, one or the other, part of one of the parking lots. We have no way to know what those 25 spaces were. We don't.
More discovery. How about that?
I don't disagree with you, Your Honor, that if we wanted to find out what those 25 spaces specifically were, that you could seek information from Allen's Asphalt to see if they remembered if there was any further details to their proposal. However, I don't think that the trial court got it wrong in stating that appellant should not be allowed to continue on with the case and to seek that discovery, because the complaint fails on its face in the first instance. So, again, they state that that pamphlet is the misrepresentation of information, but that pamphlet didn't purport to review the items done to upgrade the property since the 1980s. And there's nothing in the record that shows that any representation was ever made otherwise. They simply stated there are 6,000 square feet of office space, there are 45 parking spaces. Arl Detman reasonably relied on its contractors to pull the appropriate permits and complete the work. That's the Garrison Company and the Asphalt Company. And in fact, the Garrison Company is the company that built the building in the 1980s. So they had no reason to think that they didn't have proper approval to convert 2,000 square foot of storage space into office space. Mr. Schmidt was the liaison with the broker, but now appellants assert that if they had the opportunity to go on a fishing expedition, a baseless one, they would depose Arl Detman executives, all of them, and find out that they had somehow been put on notice of the defects when appellants know from the city of Southfield that Arl Detman was never put on notice. And they admitted as much in written communications. The fraud claims are simply a recitation of the breach of contract claims. If appellee's representation of the square footage of the building and the size of the parking lot, or even the number of bathrooms inside the building, could be considered fraud in connection with the purchase agreement, then fraud would engulf every breach of contract claim at any time when the contract is a purchase agreement for real property. That those are not fraudulent misrepresentations. Those are simply stated facts about what they're purchasing. They are purchasing 6,000 square feet of office space. They're purchasing these parking spaces. They're purchasing however many bathrooms there are, however big the basement is. Those are not fraudulent misrepresentations to induce the purchase. Those are the facts of what the building truly stood at, open and obviously, at the time of purchase. It wouldn't make sense to label this as fraud in the inducement. The only issue here is that appellants do not want to accept that they negotiated to purchase the property with its obvious accoutrements, open and obvious, as is, and do their own due diligence related to the exact thing that they now are here today complaining of. Again, I know you don't want a recitation of our brief, so I'll just point you to page 9 of our brief. At the bottom of the page, the three most important paragraphs of the purchase agreement are recited there. And the first paragraph tells you that it's understood, it's being purchased in its present condition, and it will be delivered in that exact way. Paragraph 16 states that the purchaser has a 60-day inspection period to satisfy, in its sole and absolute discretion, the following conditions: their satisfaction with all aspects of the physical and structural condition of the property, and their satisfaction with the present zoning of the property and obtaining all governing entities' approval to use the property for its intended use. If Judge Alexander got it wrong, then that would mean that...
I thought it was Judge Warren.
Judge Alexander.
Oh.
Yep. If Judge Alexander got it wrong, then that would mean that fraud should encompass the entirety of contracting. And then paragraph 37 states that the purchaser warrants and acknowledges and agrees with that the purchaser is a sophisticated purchaser. Here, opposing counsel stood in front of you today and opined that his client is not a sophisticated purchaser. So just like his client would like to back out of these other paragraphs, apparently he would also like to back out of his representation that he is a sophisticated purchaser who purchased the property as is, where is, and with all faults. Judge Alexander did not make an error when he found that the other counts of the complaint must also be dismissed relatedly. So, counsel explained that the tort claim should not be dismissed and the economic loss doctrine was misapplied, but Judge Alexander's opinion is more nuanced than counsel would like this counsel to see. He states that the duty to disclose is the separate duty that he relies upon, but as previously stated, Judge Alexander didn't negate that there's a possibility that a tort claim can arise when there's a contract. He analyzed the record and determined that in this case, there was no separate duty because the exact fraud that they're claiming is completely governed by the contracts between the parties in this case.
Okay, it did end up going to Judge Warren because I'm looking at documents that say Honorable Michael Warren.
I apologize, Your Honor. Judge Alexander did retire during this case.
Okay, thank you. I thought I had the wrong case. That's why I was like, I wanted to make sure I was on the right case. Okay.
I apologize. I do believe it was Judge Alexander's order, though.
That's fine.
He wrote the opinion.
He did. That's fine.
I apologize, Your Honor.
I just didn't want to be on the wrong case. My last case go. Anything else?
I would just lastly remind the court that this is a commercial property built in the 1980s and that these are sophisticated parties that contracted and should be held to the clear and unambiguous terms of that contract. Your Honors, if it please the court, I will briefly address our cross appeal. On cross appeal, admittedly, we would not have filed this cross appeal, this cross claim, separately had the original appeal not been brought, you know, just to be completely transparent about that. But since we are here and we had the opportunity, we did want to revisit that issue. Respondents cite to 600 MCL 600.2591 for the proposition that Arl Detman was required to file a motion. Arl Detman did file a motion for summary disposition, and in its request for relief, it asked that costs and fees would be awarded based on the filing of a frivolous complaint, and that was explicitly stated in the motion.
But there was no analysis in there.
There was no analysis, Your Honor.
That doesn't cut it.
There was no analysis, and if that doesn't cut it, then I shall say no more.
All right.
I have no questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brief rebuttal, Your Honors.
Let me ask you a question.
Absolutely.
Paragraph 28 is what you're focusing on for the breach of contract.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the evidence shows that the defendant was, let me put it this way. Even if the defendant should have known about what the 1980 plat said with respect to the parking spaces, it's undisputed that the 45 or 46 spaces existed. Southfield had done nothing, said nothing about it. They were operating with those parking spaces. So with that knowledge, why would there be any facts which might result in an action, suit, or other proceedings? Because as far as the defendant would be aware, Southfield was perfectly happy with their situation because no one had come out and complained ever.
Two points on that issue. First off, Mr. Schmidt knew per the email from Ms. Mullally in May of 2011 and per the permit that was issued in July of 2011 that the work had to be done consistent with the 1980 approved site plan. What you're asking, Your Honor, is if I violate a law, if I violate an ordinance and I don't get caught, if Southfield doesn't do its job, and if you look at the permit, it actually says final inspection required. And this is why I said in response to Judge Jansen's question, had Southfield come out and inspected and approved the work, that would be a different issue. But it's not on the record. No final inspection was done. And so the way I would respond to your question, Your Honor, is that does that mean if a party knows it has to do something consistent with an approved site plan and the municipality doesn't find out there is a deviation in violation of the permit, therefore the applicant is scot-free? I don't think that makes sense. That's kind of a perverse incentive, too. I mean, to hide and to not have full disclosure with municipality. And this whole reliance on my 2018 letter, it's really a red herring. I got involved when my client contacted me and said, RJ, we just made nearly $1 million purchase, and we're being told by the city of Southfield that the previous owner chopped all this green space out and added all these unapproved spaces. Help us out. So I looked at what I had in my possession, which was very little in 2018. I didn't have the discovery. I didn't have Mr. Schmidt's emails, et cetera. So the letter is really neither here nor there. There's no admissions. It's me trying to help my client out and finding out, well, my client's in trouble here, which led to the suit. And a point of clarity, Your Honor, it is confusing. It was actually originally assigned to Judge Warren.
Yeah.
It then got reassigned to Judge Alexander. He then retired, and now it's back in front of Judge Warren.
Okay.
The inducement, look at the brochures. There was a first brochure marked up and proposed by Mr. Kelly. And it said in that brochure, not only were there 46 spaces, but ample parking. So strange then that the second brochure that was sent to my clients, not the first brochure, removed the ample parking language. What a weird, why would you ever remove ample parking language? That's a great fact for a sale of a property. I would never remove that. Fact issue. And they're saying, well, it's
did
true.
Did it still say 46 parking spaces?
It did. And in response to the position that, oh,
ample parking is just a judgment, doesn't it? I mean, depends on the circumstances.
True, Your Honor. I just find it strange. Certainly it could go to a jury in terms of why are you modifying beneficial language regarding the specific issue in this case, which is parking spaces. And in terms of the 46 spaces being, that's true, there were 46 spaces. Well, yeah, it's true, but what you're ignoring is that the 46 spaces weren't approved in the brochures. On the issue of the owner's affidavit, I thought there was a remarkable admission on argument. Arl Detman admits that the owner affidavit was not signed as part of the purchase agreement. Exactly. It's extraneous to the purchase agreement. It was done months after during the due diligence period. It is separate and distinct from the purchase agreement. And the language, because Arl Detman suggests that this was for the title company, read the first paragraph of the affidavit. Affiant makes the representation contained herein to induce the purchaser and or lender to consummate the transaction. I mean, come on. My client received this owner's affidavit. The owner's affidavit makes additional representations that are nowhere in the purchase agreement regarding that the use of the property is in compliance with all terms, conditions, covenants, and or restrictions affecting the property. Like a site plan? Where's that in the purchase agreement? That's not in the purchase agreement at all. And this is the whole conundrum we have with saying, with the trial court finding that you've got a purchase agreement, and what you're arguing in terms of fraud is completely duplicate. No, it's not. There's no duty to disclose in the purchase agreement. This representation in the owner's affidavit nowhere is within the purchase agreement. And so this is what the court is faced with. Are we really going to allow the economic loss doctrine to be used to insulate parties from making fraudulent statements just because a purchase agreement that's tangentially related exists? I don't think that's the intention of the economic loss doctrine. Finally, Arl Detman's counsel indicated that the breach of contract claim failed on its face. No, it didn't. It was C10'd. It wasn't C8'd. And so these various questions that were posed by the court to Arl Detman regarding whether this fact matters or doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. It fails on its face. But it wasn't C8'd. It was C10'd. There are fact issues on this breach of contract claim. I have no further questions. Thank you. Or argument. Thank you.
All right. I don't think we have any other questions either, so thank you so much. This case is submitted.